of you, Jones, or seen him on television or seen him in the newspapers and...
Been to his seminars.
Been to his seminars, right? That's right. Even heard him at the Believers in Jacksonville Conference. That's right. And but you has been a man that I've known for, I guess now, at least 15, 16 years, maybe 18 years, actually. And he was one of the original members of our first tech group, along with Earl Hadlow and Lance Ringhaver and Dick Suttis and some pretty well-known people in this community. And he's an outstanding guy, and he's done so much in his life, and the whole program of working with Korean kids has been a phenomenal thing, besides, of course, leading the bank to all kinds of record growth and having it be an incredible institution here in town, Barnett Bank, that is, of course. And now it's Bank America, right? Is that right? It's kind of like the third bank. But anyway, he's graciously agreed to come and share more about what he's talked about. I call it the bottom line of compassion and how you treat people and how, you know, environments get created in an organization to help be more productive and yet at the same time more biblical. And they're looking. Anybody need any note paper while I've got this here available? There's a little handout in your things I've got too. You can take notes on that page too as well. But anyway, there's some extra paper in case you may need. It's all yours. Let's give him a round of applause, huh? For being here.
I was reminded when someone mentioned Habitat. One of the things we built, the Barnett Bank built the first Habitat house here in Jacksonville. And you know now Habitat is the largest. Jacksonville is the largest in the world.
Yeah.
The largest Habitat in the world, and it's pretty amazing. And what made me think of it, you know, they had Jimmy Carter here and Jack Kemp and Millard. I'm going to get Millard Fuller. Is it Fuller Millard or Millard Fuller, the founder of Habitat? When they were Carter's down, they built about 90 houses out there in one week. And I never heard, you know, today everyone is so sensitive about praying and hearing God, and you have to be quiet about it. I never heard so much praise the Lord in my life from people, not only the recipients, but Jimmy Carter is very committed. Millard Fuller, my God, his whole life. Here's a successful businessman that had lost his family, literally. Gave it all away and got involved in this thing. And I'm not sure about Jack Kemp, but it really was a hallelujah to go out there and see a real Christian setting of people praising God outwardly and not being embarrassed about saying it. Before I start, I just want to read one chapter, a couple of verses here. It is James 2, verse 14. It says, "Dear brothers, what's the use of saying you have faith and are Christians if you aren't proving it by helping others? Will that kind of faith save anyone? If you have a friend who is in need of food and clothing, and you say to him, 'Well, goodbye and God bless you, stay warm and eat hearty,' and you don't give him clothes and food, what good does that do? So you see, it isn't enough just to have faith. You must also do good to prove that you have it. Faith that does not show itself by good works is no faith at all. It is dead and useless." And also, there is another verse that I think is important. It's Matthew 6. Matthew 6, verse 1, it says, "Take care." And this is sort of talking, but it's very true. "Don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired, for then you will lose the reward from your Father in heaven. When you give a gift to a beggar, don't shout about it as the hypocrites do, blowing trumpets in the synagogues and streets to call attention to their acts of charity. I tell you in all earnestness that they have received all the awards they will ever get. But when you do a kindness to someone, do it secretly. Don't tell your left hand what your right hand is doing, and your Father who knows all secrets will reward you." I always like to, when I start one of these speeches, is to people say a lot of nice things about me, but there's an announcer in Chicago, God, he must be 90 years old now, called Paul Harvey. And I used to listen to Paul, and he would start telling a story, and he'd say, "Now, after the advertisement, I'm going to tell you the other side of the story, or the rest of the story. Well, let me tell you the rest of the story about me before you get started." I was absolutely, what's the word? I really was, during high school at best, I was a C student. I didn't excel at anything, and I continued that practice in college. I was on probation my sophomore year. But the thing I was proud about, I was quite an athlete, and my athletic endeavor was crew racing. But unfortunately, at Lafayette College, we didn't have any water. So crew racing at Lafayette College was beer chugging. I was a member of the Phi Delta Theta fraternity, and beer chugging was a five-man team, and we in a fraternity competition, but I was number six. I didn't even make the varsity, but I didn't put a high priority on studying, and so I was always available, and I was in every one of the matches that year, and we won the trophy, about 2 foot tall, and that was the biggest trophy on campus, and since I was there at all the matches. So I really distinguished myself a lot more from my beer drinking than anything else when I went to school. Something else I was ROTC infantry, and that was the Korean War. And I got out, and aside from excelling in playing cards and beer drinking, I realized I was going to be a platoon leader going to Korea pretty soon. And I use this expression affectionately. I didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground. I mean, I was really scared to death, not about losing my life, because back in those days, the military, you just went. You knew it was sort of God and country. You didn't. But I was concerned about being a platoon leader, didn't know anything. And so I did something that a lot of people thought I was crazy. I volunteered for something called Ranger training. And that, you saw the movie Saving Private Ryan. That was a bunch of Rangers that went back. And as a Ranger, we were taught all sorts of things. And, I learned how to blow up bridges and a lot of things. And but I was told going in, 50% of the class wouldn't finish. And with my background, a lot of people didn't think I could do it. But I did it. And I got through the thing. It was the worst 8 weeks of my life. I mean, it was absolutely hell on wheels. But I found out two things about myself when I got through it. Number one, that up to that point in my life, most of my limitations had been self-imposed. I had no confidence in myself. I didn't think I could do any good. I didn't think that I could be a leader. The second thing I learned is you never give up. Never, never, never give up. And that was what got me through that thing. I'd made up my mind that if I got kicked out, that was one thing. But if I had to hike 3 days without sleeping, I was going to do it. When I got to New York City, I started off at the Chemical Bank. I knew going in, I wasn't the smartest guy there. All the Ivy League boys were there and everything else, but I had one thing that they didn't have. I knew how to work. I knew how to work hard. And I did pretty well at the Chemical Bank. I came down here in 1970, and I sort of continued that down here. I could outwork anyone, and I was blessed that 1982, I was made head of the bank. And there were a lot of things happened around that stage of my life. Albert Ernest, who was my mentor in the bank, said, you ought to start looking around the city, and got involved with United Way. And I started seeing things around the city that I really didn't know exist. I became aware of this problems of teen pregnancy and homelessness, and AIDS was starting to come on strong. Drugs were prevalent. But the thing that I saw that really bothered me amongst the people was hopelessness. And when I would go out and see a mother and kid in a car, that turns me on. I don't feel too badly if I see a guy in the street, but when I see a mother and children. And also with that, and probably most of you would not remember this, in 1983, I think it was, there was a terrible helicopter crash in Ireland. And four of the top six people of the Charter Oil Company were killed. One of those was Jack Donnell, who was my neighbor. And I remember on television, a couple of days, a lot of television about it, but one had a scene of Jack Donnell and his senior executives painting an old folks' home. And that sort of struck with me, that why would he take some of these people and do that? That impressed me. And so I was going through this thing, and I realized, I had to sort of make some changes in my life. And I'd given money to charity, but, I never had gotten myself involved. And I kept trying to say to myself, should I do it? Should I do this? And a series of things went through my mind, and first, as volunteerism is a real tradition in America. The country does it better than we do. In the old days, house burns down, neighbors come fix it up, and there was a Frenchman by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville that was, in the late 1700s, was going around the United States, and he saw all these things happening, and he wrote in his book that Americans were the most peculiar people in the world because they got things done of their own initiative. There wasn't any government to help them, they just did it. And I think down through the period of time of a person like William Wilson, who in 1934 started Alcoholics Anonymous, can you imagine the number of people that AA has helped tens of thousands of people and all the love and compassion that they've given to this thing. There's no government agency in the world that could recreate that. And people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was a woman who fought for economic opportunity for women. Maybe they've gone too far now, but who knows, but you know, get the right to vote and all those issues. So there are people like that that took the initiative. And so certainly I was aware of that. Certainly there's a spiritual aspect, which I talked about here, about giving back and volunteering. Maybe with me, it was my conscience was catching up with me. Maybe I had a sense of responsibility that I should do something. Maybe I thought that if I could get involved in it and could give some leadership, that others might follow. I also thought it wouldn't be bad for the bank. I knew it wouldn't be bad. I thought there might be some good could come of it for the bank. But I realized at that point in my life I was missing something. At that point, I was starting to make a decent salary for the first time in my life, but I was missing something which I call psychic income. Now, you can call it spiritual income, but I, in this case, prefer to call it psychic income. I define psychic income as the unconditional giving of yourself to help others. It's when we give our love away unconditionally to others, then our soul nourishes our body and our spirit. So it's giving away, helping other people unconditionally. One of the examples of that had a dramatic change in my life, I was involved in a program of bringing Korean children over here. And the reason I got involved in that thing, some of you may remember Roland Kennedy. His stepson died in heart surgery at University Hospital around 1984. And I wanted to do something to memorialize it. And so this thing of bringing some Korean children came in. We brought the first Korean child here in 1985. Can you imagine sending your six-year-old child 14,000 miles for surgery by herself? She came here and actually with a seven-year-old boy, just the two of them came here, picked them up, and I really liked this little girl. And even though I couldn't communicate, she stayed with my wife and me. And remember on a Sunday night, I took her down to the hospital, and I went home and I couldn't sleep. I was wide awake, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, I went down to the hospital to sit by her side. And 6 o'clock, all the nurses came in and started putting needles in her and everything else. And for the first time, I saw tears in this kid's eyes. And I looked at her, and then for some reason, she turned around to me and put her arms up to me. This is the person she had known for 3 days. And they let me pick her up, and that kid started hugging me, and I started hugging her. And the fact of the matter was that particular morning we both needed to be hugged. And that little girl, six-year-old girl, taught me that even though there was a language difference, a cultural difference, an age difference, and a color difference, all that could be somehow with love. That little girl now is 22 years old. I saw her about a year ago. She graduated second in her class. She wouldn't be alive today. She didn't have surgery. And I tell her that story, and of course she thinks I'm blowing smoke at her. You know, how could I affect the life of a CEO of a bank? The fact of the matter is, this and the nail thing all started waking me up a good bit. And so for all these reasons, I decided to commit myself in the bank to volunteerism. And later this led me to the Baptist Healthcare Foundation and pursuit of other philanthropic causes that I've gotten involved in. What I did at the bank, I had three women that I relied on very heavily, Jane Jordan, Judy Jacobson, and Mary Sue Sperlin, and they formed what I call my kitchen cabinet. And these three women, I wouldn't do a thing in the bank except lending without talking to them, because they really knew what was going on. And we came up with an idea. We had about 35 or 40 budgeting units in the bank at that time. And we decided we were going to ask each of them to take on a volunteer project. And the key was we told them we wanted a bottoms-up project. We didn't want the branch manager running it. We said, you find someone in your office who has some leadership, give them the opportunity. And the idea was that they would pick up a project. We used Volunteer Jacksonville to help line up. We wanted to get something in their area that they would be interested in. And the idea was that they would come up with a project, and each budget time, they would come in and tell us what they did that previous year, and then they would tell us what they're going to do the following year. And we didn't, all we said was one project. Now, as it turned out, some got more involved than others, but that was the idea. I believe very much that when you rate people, that you should not, when you're going over a person's review that it should not be very subjective. I mean, I think you have to have things they can measure by, your positive growth or whatever it might be. But in this case, even though the managers were not responsible, they knew that 10 to 15% of the evaluation would be how well they did this project and how well they got their people involved. So we did that. And what came out of this thing was amazing to me. Habitat, you know, we built the first house. The Barnett was the one that put together the group to build the first Ronald McDonald House. We raised $600,000. We got about $600,000 in kind, and we built it. Started a program called Inroads. Inroads is a program, we were the first bank to offer it in Florida. It's a program that takes minorities who are committed to 4 years in college. We would get them a job in the summertime. And the idea was that they're trying to keep these minorities in Jacksonville. And we used what I called a rifle approach. I mean, these had to be kids that would commit to stay in and would commit to take these jobs. We weren't trying to get everybody. But the bottom line is that they're still taking in about 30 kids a year and teaching them about the free enterprise system. That's really what it was, teaching them what America's about with the free enterprise system. A great program. We started programs 20 years ago. If you weren't white and if you didn't have a father or uncle working for the fire department, you couldn't get in that department. We developed a program with FCCJ in which I think it was 6 weeks. These guys, people went to school during that period with FCCJ. We got about 95 people in the fire department. They finished the school and completed the requirements. They were guaranteed a job in the fire department. And that was the first real breakthrough in that area. We started a program of taking women off of welfare by giving them some training, once again, with FCCJ as to how they could have home care in their home, up to five kids. These people could start grossing about 13, 14,000 years ago. We took someone from our bank as a mentor. So not only were we helping these take people off welfare, we were teaching our people something by getting out and working with these folks. We started the Pops concerts. Those Pops concerts you see right now, we started it. And with Skitch Henderson was the person we got down here, and we were very much involved. The hospice program was basically all but bankrupt. Our financial controls department took that project on. We got a new leadership down there. We got a board for them, encouraged them on, and that's now the Earl Hadlow Center down there in Sunbeam Road. It's a great facility. And probably the one that I am probably enjoyed as myself, Tom McGee came to me once, and I went and got Steinmark. We started Dreams Come True. And that organization, about 6 months ago, gave their 1,000th dream. It was an interesting story about this psychic income thing. I'll just relate it to you. It was about 3 weeks ago, I was walking out of Ruth Chris restaurant, and this man comes up to me and says, you recognize me? Do you know who I am? And I said, no. And, you know, oftentimes I remember faces. I can't remember names. And I said, no, what's your name? And he said, my name is Wing Barnes. And I said, I still can't put it together. And he said, well, 14 years ago, you arranged for my kid to go to Los Angeles to go to the Olympics. What's this guy talking about? And I realized that was the year we started Dreams Come True. And I remembered vaguely about this kid. It was an expensive dream, but we got him out to the Olympics. The point to me, here is something that happened 14 years ago, and all of a sudden this guy comes up. And you don't think that made me feel good? You know, I had no way in the world to think, how would that guy even remember me? But those are the sort of things, what I call psychic income. You never know when you're gonna get it. Oftentimes we do things at the time, people don't acknowledge it the way we think they should or the way we want them to. But I'm gonna tell you, baby, those things are going on and they come back to you in the darndest ways. There were four things that we saw happen in the bank because of these activities. Four things that we saw develop that I think were very powerful. First was teamwork. You know, in any sort of a large company, you can have departments that people really don't know each other. I mean, they're really strangers, they work together. In these projects, we encourage the families to get involved in them. You know, kids, spouses coming out, all painting a house or something. We saw unbelievable teamwork improve in many of our departments because these people got to know each other better. Many times they'd have to cover for each other. You know, they're out buying the paint or something. So we found cooperation. So we saw teamwork. One of the best examples of this that I can, over at Baptist Hospital, the maintenance people at Baptist Hospital decided they want to start a fishing tournament. That fishing tournament is now the largest bass tournament, I think, east of Mississippi. They have it out here. I think last year they had it out of Palatka. These are maintenance people. They run it. They do everything about it. Every year now, they're giving about $100,000 to Wilson Children's Hospital. Now, here's a bunch of people, and they are so proud of that thing. And, you know, everyone talks about the maintenance people at Baptist have done this, and they do it by themselves. Things like that. Teamwork. Second thing was leadership. We saw unbelievable things happening in the leadership area, teaching leadership. I define leadership as getting people to willingly do things they normally don't do. That's one very simple way to describe leadership. But there were a number of things we saw happen to develop leadership among our people. You know, volunteering is certainly it's a value system. It teaches ethics. I mean, it's ethical. You know, it's the golden rule. So certainly that is, I think, that's a part of leadership. Leadership has to have morale in your troops. I remember one time that a university hospital, I was going up in an elevator, and this charwoman said, "Aren't you the man that's involved with the Korean children?" And I said, "Yes, I am, ma'am." And she got this smile on her face, and she said, "I certainly am proud of that." And I thought, wasn't that something that a charwoman in the hospital would feel some equity of bringing children 14,000 miles? Bottom line was the following year, a university hospital doubled its participation in United Way, and it doubled the amount of money, just because I think people that, you know, that's our indigent hospital. Back then, it was really our indigent hospital. Mm-hmm. And pride that those people got, that people would look at university hospital as a place of bringing kids in this charwoman. Respect. Respect, I think, is part of leadership. Someone said once that the only time you look down on someone is when you're helping them up. If you're involved in volunteer work, you are helping people up. I think that also is a value of leadership. Responsibility. You know, these kids would have to go out and arrange for the paint, arrange for all the cooking the food, providing the food. Leadership involves success and failure. And, you know, all of our projects didn't work out well. And I remember one time, do any of you know who Wally Amos is? Sure. The Cookie Man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a chance to be with Wally Amos about 2 years ago. Wally Amos has made $1 million and lost $1 million twice. He's now on his third round coming up. And Wally Amos is now coming back with muffins. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with Wally Amos and I was telling him, I said, "Gosh, I sure am proud of you, happy you're coming back." And I said, "You've been beaten down and everything else." And he turned around to me and said, "Hugh, the only reason I am where I am today is because of all the mistakes I've made." And I thought about that. You know, that's pretty good. I've learned more from my mistakes. I really have. I've learned more about myself from my mistakes than the normal things I do every day. So, you know, we found our people giving, you know, learning all things, goal setting, developing new skills, esteem, psychic income, all of these things. So leadership, we saw leadership develop in people. Two quick examples of that. Diane Williams was a trainee on our training program, and I've told Diane this story, so I'm not telling stories out of school. But Diane was nice, but I thought sort of nondescript, and just was going to be a, you know, decent employee. All of a sudden, I saw in the paper one morning that Diane Williams was the second leading seller of chamber memberships. I don't know if they still do that here in Jacksonville, but Diane Williams, she can sell? She's a hustler? Bottom line is, and she was out in the community. Bottom line was, Diane Williams was the second woman to be made the president of a Barnett Bank. Jeff Atwater. Jeff Atwater was had gone to seminary 1 year, was going to be a priest, and he fell in love. His potential wife came to see me about a job. I hired him, and about a year later, I heard about him going down to Brazil along the Amazon River, passing out blankets. And I saw this guy, and you know, he was a remarkable young guy. And I was impressed with this guy, that he took the initiative of doing these things. Bottom line was that Jeff ended up being the youngest person ever to be made a bank president in the Barnett Bank system.
Wow.
All these things we saw, and all these people would be the first to say that they started getting confidence in leadership ability because of what they were doing outside of the bank. Wally Bars, God bless him, his daddy was head of the parks department here. Wally Bars was about as nondescript a guy that you ever meet in your life. And his daddy came in to me and pleaded with me to hire him, pleaded with me. I've only done this twice in my life. The first time was a failure. I said, all right. And I thought I could bury this kid out in the installment loan department or something. About 2 years later, I got this call from our office on 130th Street. This guy is unbelievable. They gave him the job of heading up this community project. And, I mean, he absolutely found himself because he started getting confidence in himself. And, you know, Wally Bars was never going to be a bank president, but Wally Bars had found himself. And he's told me, he said, it gave me some confidence getting out and making things happen. So we found a lot of leadership coming about, developing in people that we didn't know had it. The third thing was, obviously, we gained, customer respect and some business. And, you know, I read that thing in the Bible. I don't think any of us should go out and tout what we do. I think doing it quietly, but, you know, I don't see anything wrong. There's nothing, you know, if you do these things and the bank gets acknowledgement for it, there's nothing wrong with that. And during that period of the 80s, until everything hit the fan about 1990, we were making every year 12 to 15% increase in earnings. Our return on equity was 18 to 20%. And during those years, our return on assets was 1.8 to 2.1%. And that's off the wall for a bank. Now, it all kind of fell apart in 1990 when we went through that tough period. But we were making all sorts of money. But there were three situations there, and I think of customer respect, that really struck me. One was we built the Ronald McDonald House. At that point, McDonald's franchises are very fragmented here in town. There's probably 12 or 13 of them. When we started the Ronald McDonald, we had two customers in that group. 3 years later, we had all but two had transferred to us. You know, we didn't call it the Ronald McBarnett House. And, you know, what I say, we sort of embarrassed these people into giving us the business. And, and we weren't above reminding them what we did, but it was a source of, we didn't do it for that reason going in. But that was a dividend that came from it. Some of you may remember Brockway Corporation when it came into town about, 12, 13 years ago. And I thought I had a good pipeline that I would hear about these things coming in. But, you know, back then there were really three large banks, Atlantic, Florida, and Barnett. And I found out that Billy Walker had hustled it. I found out Charlie Hughes had hustled it. And they were up in Pennsylvania. And I thought, oh, my God. But I decided I took a trip up there and to see them up in Brockway, Pennsylvania. Went up one morning and sat down with Jack Winfield and talked to him. And probably my propensity of drinking beer, my family owns a brewery up in Pittsburgh. Brockway made among other things, beer bottles. And so I said, gee, maybe my brewery up there, or maybe my family brewery bought some bottles. And he right away said, no, they were nervous. flat on its butt. But I liked Jack. And I came back down, and I still was very discouraged because when you have Charlie Hughes and Billy Walker ahead of you, then I heard they're going to move in the Florida National Bank building. That's the building where
the Army is in.
Yeah, right. And no chance in the world. Well, about 2 weeks when they moved into town, Jack Winfield came over, and he said, we're going to give you all of your business, all of our business. About a month later, I said, why'd you do that? And he said, well, it was interesting. Three good banks. We liked them all, but the difference was where we came from, we were very involved in our community. We checked around. Barnett did it better than anybody else. And we got a couple million dollars in deposits. Now, unfortunately, they were bought, left town about 3 years later. But the fact is, we got that business. Only the little extra thing we had was people, they perceived that we cared about our community. The last story I have is we had this part-time teller out at Roosevelt, and she was the number one signer-upper for, like, you know, if you sign up, you get 50 cents a mile. If you walk for cancer, March of Dimes, whatever it might be. And every year, this girl was number one. And I said, I got to meet this girl. Part-time teller, married, two children. And I found out that what she did, when people would line up behind that drive-in teller, you know, there'd be two or three open, they'd drive up, because what she did when she signed up, she made cookies. And everyone that signed up, she gave a little platter of cookies. Mm-hmm. And she was affectionately known as the cookie lady out of Roosevelt. And the fact of the matter is, that office was so proud of that girl. I mean, this, you know, the paper talked about the cookie lady at Roosevelt office. All those things happened. And you know, all these things happened, they just happened because we were doing the right thing. The fourth thing was, obviously, it made us feel good about ourselves. It made our people feel good. And I think the final culmination of all of this was that in 1993, President Bush gave us his points of light. I think we're the second person in this area to get that, and we made it about 30 days before we went out of office. And that day, I think we lit 1,000 candles around Jacksonville celebrating, and this to me was a celebration of 900 people doing a great job. And, you know, we didn't force our people to volunteer. You know, they didn't, you know, some had excuses to involve in their family. Some were afraid they might get criticized. You know I got some phone calls while I was taking care of Korean children. You know, there were good reason for it, but sometimes you get in a volunteer project, you get sleepless nights, you start worrying about it. I tell you, the sleepless night I had with a young Jew was the best sleepless night I ever had in my life, as it turned out. And you know, this thing about the psychic income, it's pretty hard for a CPA to measure it. You know, where do you put it on your balance sheet? But it's there. It is there in the numbers, but there's no CPA in the world that I have ever found out that really can absolutely give an opinion that can put it on that statement, but it's there. And, you know, there's another thing that happens, and this scares some people, that if you get involved and do it well, you know what happens? You get asked to do even more. That's the bottom line of it. The key on something like this, you know, if you don't have empathy for this at the top, your CEO is not going to work. It's not going to work. The CEO is the heart of this thing. He's the role model. That doesn't mean that the rest of you, if you don't have that role, can't get started at it, get his concurrence, but you've got to have some leadership at the top. I look at a corporation as being a four-legged stool. One of the legs are the shareholders, the owners. You know, you have to give them a return on their investment. You can't stay in business in this country unless you can make some money and return it to them. The second thing is the customer. For customers, you have to have a good product. You have to have good service. And my experience has been that caring people give better service. If people are happy in their job, if they're proud of where they work, they give better service. So that thing ties in there. Employees are the third leg. Employees are important. You have to have a good environment for them. You've got to pay them a free salary. That's another leg. The last leg is giving back into the community. I think the legs have to be balanced. You have to keep them balanced, but I think all four. I read somewhere, and I think this is the key of all what I'm saying this morning, is this. Profits are to business as breath is to life. But you don't live to breathe. You breathe to live. You don't live to breathe, you breathe to live. In my judgment, companies should not live or exist to make a profit. They make a profit so they can serve people. And I believe that from the bottom of my life, the bottom of my heart. You know, I look at a man's personal life, and I look at it as a three-legged stool. The seat of that stool has to be your spiritual belief. That has to be the center of it. And there's three legs. Your job, your family, and giving back. And my legs on my stool were unbalanced for a while. I neglected my family for a while, and that evolved into the biggest failure in my life was a divorce, because I didn't have my stool balanced. So I can preach about this because I went through it and went through the pain of it. I look at a life as being what I call a little bunch of circles. Am I okay on time?
Yeah, sure.
Every day, all of us create circles, what I call circles, incidents. And these things interconnect. You can have positive circles or negative circles. You can have a bunch of them, you can have quality, you can have quantity, but they all interconnect. Just to give you an example of one circle in my life was when we started the Korean Heart Program. We started because of the death of the stepson of William Kennedy. We started the Korean Heart Program, so that led to the Korean Heart Program, and our goal was to do two children and try to raise $25,000, $30,000 endowment to honor this boy. From that, we ended up doing 71 children, and we gave the University of Florida $1 million endowment to honor Glenn Chuck. Because of this program in 1989, I met a little 9-year-old girl who had basically was orphaned. Her father was dead, mother abandoned. She came over here, she came back when she was 10 years old, I fell in love with this kid, kept in touch with her, and when she was around 13 or 14 years old, totally indigent, I said, if you have a dream to go to college, and you want me to make it available, if God keeps me here long enough. She called me about 5 years ago, and at this point, I was daddy, and she was my daughter. She said she wanted to come to America. Abby is an honor student at Hollins College, and will graduate this year. All because a little boy died back here. In 1990, I was recognized in Washington with what they called a caring award, which I got for my involvement really for this, really for more of this corporate volunteerism thing that they picked up. Someone picked up, sent in a thing, and I got that. But through that award, I had the opportunity of meeting Bush, Reagan. I met a man named Henry Landruth, who is the person that there is an organization in Orlando called Give Kids the World, where dying children can go for a last dream, you know, see Mickey Mouse, and most kids, interestingly, our dreams come true here in Jacksonville. One third of the kids in Jacksonville want to go to Orlando, Give Kids the World. They go down there 6 days, everything is VIP, no cost, everything's taken care of, so dying children can have it. I met Henry Landruth through that. I met a lot of other interesting people. And, you know, it all started because of something that was like a little, what I call a little mustard seed. It happened, I got involved, and all of a sudden this thing started to grow and grow and grow. In fact, I probably wouldn't be here today talking to you if that boy hadn't died in heart surgery. That's how these things, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. This thing I told you about, this guy coming up to me, coming out of Ruth Chris restaurant. You know, no way in the world I would have remembered that man, but those things come back to you. There is a Chinese proverb that says, tell me, I'll forget. Show me, I may remember, but involve me and I'll understand. And I think that's the key to it. I want to read one last thing that a friend of mine made he was getting an honorary degree at UNF. And I think this sort of sums it up for all of us. It says, use all the potential God has given you and learn to give. Know that no act of compassion, however small, is ever wasted. Begin with one good deed. Do the best thing you can think of with each moment and every opportunity life presents. Place one simple caring act before another. Then count others upon them until no nook, cranny, or crack appears visible and your life is seamless. Remember that when you are employed in serving others, you are not so much conferring favors as repaying debts. People light candles, dispel the darkness, go forth, illuminate the world. I believe that, and I think that each one of us in this room has that opportunity to do it in our own way, finding our own little projects of caring and giving back. I know it has changed my life, and I know I'm a better man because of it. And obviously, I believe in what I'm talking about. Thank you all very much.
Questions anybody might have? Jay? Thank you. That
yes.
Wonder Byron again. A lot of the wonderful things that your benevolent heart has allowed to happen in Barnett.
It was the people. All I was the orchestrator. But, sure. You know, I had 900 people that were playing all the instruments. I happen to believe in it, but, you know, it wasn't me, it was the people in the bank. I got a lot of the recognition for it, but they are the ones that did the hard work.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you, since you were the leader and obviously many talented people were able to use their skills because of your leadership, when it came time to decide how you want to go about doing a community service project, or you feel some urge to do something, a little bit of what you described sounded like what I would call off-budget projects. Mm-hmm. Was the company's main thrust in these projects to maintain it in an off-budget category, or did the bank actually identify a charitable budget that would be divvied in a certain way that would help some of these things? Was there a method
to that? We tell the branch, we'll pick up any expenses. We picked up the meals, the paintbrushes. You know, they had to come up with a reasonable budget, but you know, you're talking probably $200, so it was peanuts.
Right.
You know, I remember down at the hospice, I bought more spaghetti dinner tickets I ever bought in my life, because that was the way we started raising some money for it. The out-of-pocket for the bank was very, very minimal. I mean, it just didn't involve that much money. It was time. You know, you go paint a house.
Right.
What's it cost? It cost you $100 to buy the paint and some brushes, $200. So we would just tell the branch manager, and they would take it out of their budget. We might have put a little smidgen in there. You know, each branch had a $500 budget or something for community, something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I think we did have. We actually gave them a designation. If it was going to be more than that, they'd come talk to us about it.
So in essence, it was the manpower and the will of the staff to create the teamwork idea, and incidental costs were covered. Now, elaborate and help me a little bit, because my experience with our small company is, and you alluded to this as well, you know, we get called all the time, you know, give for this, give for that, give for this, give for that. So my mentality has been shaped by the fact that to be a benevolent corporate citizen is to write checks.
But see, that's the mistake that I made personally. I was writing checks. But, you know, I got to the point, I just, you know, and we had to do that. You know, we knew we had to buy the dinner. But that, to me, that to me is like saying, hey, take it, don't bother me. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes businessmen, you have to do it. You can't get away from it.
Right.
But to me, that is the easy way out. And corporations do that, I think they're missing the boat on it. Any company. I think the key is, the key to me and our people was the psychic income, the feeling we got back about, you know, when you go see, you know, if you go out to this Habitat thing and you see these people get up and giving their testimony, tears coming down their eyes, you see a woman with three children and she has a home. I mean, you walk away from that thing and I can hardly wait for next year. I mean, really, you know, you tell me when I got to shut up, but I'm going to wonder a story. I got involved in the Sulzbecher Center, and I, you know, that led me to the Sulzbecher Center 6 years ago. A Habitat house, Butch Toney and I, Butch Toney's a builder here in town, and I, last year we decided we would do a house together. And when I was doing this house, the potential owner came up and said, Mr. Jones, you wouldn't recognize me, but I was a resident down at the Sulzbecher Center. And what had happened, he'd been down there, had gotten out, had gotten involved in the church, and had married a nice woman, two children, and in effect, this was the house he was going into. So this year, the Sulzbecher puts on a fashion show every year. And we use the residents who have succeeded to come down and put Steinmark clothes on them. It's I mean, it is a first-class fashion show, but we tell the story of the person. Well, the story they told this year was the story of, and Butch and I walk him out of the podium, the story of how this guy had come to Sulzbecher, now had a home tied into the Habitat. I asked this guy behind stage, I said, what made you change? And he looked at me and said, Mr. Jones, what made me change? I said, I had been an alcoholic all of my life. Then I had a granddaughter was born. And he said, I didn't want my granddaughter to think of me as a father. And through the church and through a good woman that he married, this guy's gonna make it. But you see this thing of you provide this, and you know, probably 75% of the people at Sulzbecher are not going to get permanently helped, but you don't know which one, so you work with all of them. But here's a guy, and you know, hell, I feel good about that. I walked off that stage that I heard that story. I'm going to do another one next year. And that's what keeps me going, is this psychic income of seeing that maybe I can do something to affect a life. I had someone...
Go ahead. We've got another
5 minutes. I mean, this was, tell me, you know, I've never really told this story to a group before, but I think it's important. When I was at the Chemical Bank, there's a guy in Miami named Sam Adler, and he did some business with us, and he took a liking to me. And Sam one time asked me if I would like to take a 10% interest in an apartment thing he was building, and we weren't financing. I went back and I said, no conflict of interest. Probably today that would be perceived a conflict. So I took a 10% interest in this thing, and back then you didn't have to put much equity into a big project, and the equity to come up with $35,000. Hell, I didn't have $35,000. I was, my total net worth at that stage, I was 38 years old, maybe $300,000. So what they did is this group went out and they borrowed the $300,000. Sam had millions of dollars, so he wasn't poor. I was the only poor one in there. And so I went on this note, not joint and several, for my share, and enormous project was built. Every year, I would get this nice tax deduction. Back then, you could take it against your income, and every year, I'd get this thing for $5,000 or $6,000. So about 1973 or four, Sam called me on the phone and said, we're going to sell this project. And I said, oh, Sam, you know, I really. He said, well, don't you want to know what your share is? I said, yeah. He said, your share is $500,000. I said, what'd you say? Your share, now mind you, this is 74. You can realize, put that thing, wow. At that time, maybe my total net worth had grown to $400,000. And he said, I have a favor I want you to do. He said, would you give 20% of it to the United Jewish Appeal of Miami? I said, Sam, what do you want? You know, that year, I've been on their mailing list ever since. I gave them $125,000. The bottom line was, cash after tax was $425,000. I don't know what Sam saw in me, but he liked me. He wanted to give me an opportunity to move ahead. And I made up my mind that if I saw a young person that I could help, give him a loan or help a scholarship, I would just do it. And the only thing I would do when I did it, I would tell this story about Sam. And in many cases, if it was a loan, I never would charge interest. If it was a scholarship, something like that, I'd say, look, you don't owe me anything, but sometime you help somebody else. And I've done this about 25 or 30 times in my life since then, for just sometimes, you know, $500 to Harvey Anderson, or, you know, you can find things. Harvey's not one of the best investments I've made, but, you know, you do it because you want to give him the chance to do it. And Sam was dying here about 10 years ago. I went down to see him. Very emotional about it. And shoot his wife out of the room, and I cried and cried and said, Sam, you don't know what that meant to me. And I told him, the rest of my life, when I do something like this, I'm going to tell him why I'm doing it for you. Remember, in here said, I'm not concurring a favor. I'm repaying a debt. And that, it was things like that in my life that someone saw some good in me, a kid that just about flunked out of college. And that's what motivates me at age 70. If I can find ways to help people, and what I hope is that those people maybe in turn will find someone that they can help. And that's like this mustard seed. If I plant it right, it's watered, and I have the right people, the people out there that will turn around and do something else, and they'll say, hey, I knew some old banker that saw some good in me. And that's what it's all about, guys, finding ways to help people.
Stand up, give him a standing ovation.
That's
powerful.
Well, that story about Sam, I've never told that publicly before, but I think in this group, it's, you know, it's just,
Amen.
They gave me the first security that I really had in my life, that I knew that at that point that my kids were going to college, and I knew I wouldn't. So that last thing of confidence, and all those things, I think, and this thing came around to be involved and get back in the community. It was really easy for me to see the benefit of it, because I had benefited myself.
Well, that was great.
Okay, guys.
Thank you very much. Yeah, tremendous. Go around the room and find out, you know, what did Hugh Jones say that, you know, has impact for you, or has an idea, or has something you should do something about, a thought or an inspiration. Or something you ought to research or delegate. Okay, Jay's going to start. Go
and ahead. I hit upon it somewhat in my questions to Hugh, but essentially the difference between establishing your charitable budget and writing checks to whatever client calls you to ask for money, the difference between that and then having the soul of your company being involved in charitable works, that's the difference between night and day.
Yeah.
And I know on my perspective, I'm so used to that first scenario I described. To me, that's all that's been. Mm-hmm. Now I'm more interested in the latter method, that of letting the charitable interest drive whatever else drives it. So that kind of encourages me. Well, that definitely encourages me because I have to do this.
Puts a deeper perspective on it, doesn't it?
To really apply those types of good works in a teamwork situation for us, as opposed to letting some guy upstairs in the clerk's office just write checks and us feel good about that. You know, that type
yeah.
of thing. So that's interesting to me.
Yeah, that was good.
Writing checks is still good, of course.
Yeah, it is needed. Absolutely. I was just also thinking when he was talking that there, when you asked the question, that there possibly is a prototype or something that the bank put together.
Right.
About how they got started and how they outlined that.
Yeah.
Good. That's good. Since the Barnett Bank doesn't exist anymore, you can copy anything they have.
That's right.
I'm sure the assets were purchased, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like primarily the capital, right? Well, who else is going to share an idea you got from what you just said?
To me, the thing I like the most you said was, and it's emphasize the humility of what we need to do is we're not conferring a favor, but we're fulfilling responsibility.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do that Lubicon or FCA. But it's really just a normal course of business. Yeah, there's a little extra effort we have to do, but it really isn't getting the people involved. And I like the Chinese proverb we use. Now you can, you can tell me and I'll forget. You can show me and I might remember, or you can involve me and I'll understand.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, talk about the spiritual income, the psychic income.
Yeah.
You have to create something that allows your people to get that.
Yeah.
To share in that.
Yeah.
And this is your warm fuzzy. So that's. I got to figure out some ways to improve some of the things that we participate in and do, so our people get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in a larger sense, it's the leader's responsibility to teach that, because quite honestly, this is not taught.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of what he was saying was reinforcing what I've been doing for the last 5 to 8 years in volunteering with Junior Achievement. And while I don't have the kind of profound experiences and stories he did, I mean, I've had kids come to me, and as I was walking through the Roosevelt Mall or whatever, and come up to me and say, do you remember me? And this is just 2 years ago that I taught on a class on entrepreneurship and business and for Junior Achievement, and they know how to balance their checkbook.
Yeah,
because
that's good.
I can tell you that, you know, I'm frustrated with that experience, and, you know, I have to get up early to go teach these kids, and a lot of the times none of them are listening, and it really, you know, irritates you when you're there, you know, giving of yourself, and I could be productive this day, and I spent 3 hours, you know, with these kids, and they don't pay attention, but then for that one kid to say something in the mall makes all those days where you wanted to just, you know, pop them. You know, it makes it all worthwhile, and I'm telling you that as a leader, what Hugh said to me was, not only is it important for us to do these things for our own benefit, you know, for that feeling of gratitude, but I think we have to convey that to other people and teach them that they too can be empowered by that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a significant message that maybe wasn't as obvious as, you know, as doing it just for ourselves.
He even stated about giving people a review. When he gave them a review, 15% of their promotional review was based upon how they adopted and acted on these challenges that were set forth. So
that's pretty heavy.
So they really made it. It wasn't a fuzzy statement. They knew what they were going for. They knew the values they had set. Mm-hmm. They knew what their charities were.
Yeah.
No, we don't have a lot of us in the room don't have the employees that you have to get involved in these projects. I mean, we're just a five-person shop. And this week, the last 2 weeks, I've had the opportunity to go to fundraising banquets. I went to the First Coast Women's Service, who opposes abortion, strong policy. policy in mind.
You can say that in this room.
We always temper our stuff. You know, like, I think even Hugh has tempered his, call it psychic income versus spiritual. He's always talking to all different kind of people.
Right, yeah,
it's okay. We're with you, baby.
But I did that one. And then Tuesday night, I went to the Trinity Rescue Mission. Uh-huh. Now, both of these are customers. We do all the printing for them. And the third one we've had this week is a young, I don't know, maybe 19, 20-year-old girl who is leaving next week for Budapest, Hungary, for a 9-month missionary journey. And so we adopted her as a group. Again, we got the graphics person is donating her time, her little bit of time to do these envelopes that she's going to get her funds, send out mail out. And we donated the printing, and we just got everybody involved. The pressman, understands what this is for, and it's good. But we're trying to get our employees thinking in terms of helping. We haven't volunteered to go down to and serve meals or anything to that effect yet, but we are supporting both financially and with
time
business and thing, this type of thing with these. We're partnering, I guess, is a better expression.
Yeah.
And we went to this banquet, and to hear these people, like he said, get up and testify and give their testimony, it tears your heart out. Just to see it happen, it's a great feeling to know that you are participating in what little way you can. We can't build a house, but we can participate.
Anybody else want to share?
Good about ourselves.
Good. Anybody else got an idea you want to share?
I'm involved in a prison ministry. We go down to Putnam Correctional on Thursday nights and put on a Bible study. When he said that 75% of the people at the homeless shelter may not actually make it, but think of the 25% or so that may, and that's an encouragement to me because we see some guys get out who don't really make it once they get out and they end up back in prison. But it's a good reminder to think about the ones that do make it, and you are having an impact.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've in writing the book that I did and learning more about things, we all fill up our time with things. And sometimes, we got the business pressure of get this thing done, open a new branch, get that guy trained, do all these kind of things, and we are running around trying to get all those things done. But the truth of the matter is, I believe God is looking upon us, not only what we do in our business, but what we do outside of our business in our community. And the things that, John Braddock just got back from Brazil, and he'll probably share some of these pictures here a minute, but the point is that God is wanting to bless us, looking for ways to bless us, and it's not always right in the business. You know what I mean? We get sometimes overly focused on that. It's just giving time, being available to somebody when they call and say, hey, will you counsel me about a job or will you do this or that? But I things that he said here that really impacted me, when I think about what I learned first about leadership, was a little bit in high school through sports, then into college through my fraternity, and the role models I had in the fraternity who were all involved in the university or the campus, the activities that went on. And I was like you, Jones. I was a C student at best, I didn't even care about any of that stuff. But I learned so much more. I had my 35th fraternity reunion 2-3 weeks ago in St. Louis. I went to Southern Illinois University. It was really fun and exciting to see all these people. Gray hair, pot bellies, all that kind of thing. No hair, all that. But the point is that it was very exciting, and it brought me back to so much of what I learned about leadership. I learned leadership in that fraternity, in that school. I really sincerely did. And then my wife and I went into the Peace Corps for 2 years. I learned about leadership in a way, I know not many people get a chance to learn about it. But he was talking about that these people, they learned teamwork, leadership, respect, goal setting, and discovering their talents. There are five things by getting out of the bank In other words, sometimes your organization doesn't teach what you really need to be teaching about people growing up or taking initiative or whatever because they just do their job. You know what I mean? Here's some people who were in accounting that grew up and became leaders, okay? And accounting can be boring and it's numbers and it's focused, but leadership is about communicating.
Never dull. Okay?
Leadership is about getting involved and expressing yourself. And so I think to me how powerful that is to say that stepping out of your job or out of your box, if you want to call it that, into the community, help people learn leadership skills they brought right back into the bank. You see what I mean?
Right.
It was just, it's moving back and forward. And so, I mean, there's so much, you know, that he said that's very powerful and very deep. And John and I were talking yesterday about someone that he's very close to, who's very frustrated with church and ticked off at God because someone in the church who was very instrumental and a very godly person died too early, you know, at a young age. And here is Hugh bringing up a wonderful example about Roland Kennedy. Anybody ever meet him? He was a real high-level guy at the bank, and he lost his son. I mean, what happened? What, like a ripple effect from his son dying?
Yeah, I never understood. He was his son at the bank died.
Not Hughes, but Roland Kennedy's
son. Roland Kennedy, a bank employee's son died.
Right.
Now, how did that connect to career?
It was a heart. He had a heart problem.
Yeah, but how did that connect to bringing kids from Korea? That's what I know.
Well, Hugh Jones was in Korea in the war, and then evidently he kept in communication. He didn't tell that story here, but kept in communication with some Koreans. And one of them called one day and said, hey, and then the heart thing, they just got, and they'd raised some money. You see what I mean? Through Roland's kin, and then started doing some other things, and so it touched him to the point where he got involved in his. It was almost his personal project. It wasn't the bank. He went to Korea like 14 times, brought people, kids back, you know, for heart surgery and all of that kind of thing. But the point of it is, he's saying that impacted him. Roland Kennedy's son passing away, it touched him. You know, even like the fellow with Charter, that touched him. You know, someone's life being lost touches us if we're open to it, if we're open to say, okay, God, what can I do about that? What can I, how can we memorialize that person, or how can we take initiative to make sure that doesn't happen again? I mean, that's what God's trying to tell all of us, you know. When will you listen to me, he's trying to say, you know, about cancer or about heart disease or all these other kind of things, about changing your lifestyle and getting in tune with me and getting onto my path, you know, that I've identified for you. And so, but God allows us to go through all the pain and suffering. And he said it himself. You know, he learned a whole lot more through the pain and frustration of his life, right? Anyway, I think this is a powerful talk. The more you hear it and the deeper you get with it, because it's a, there's so much value to all of this, and it's all biblical, as he started out by saying and reading the scriptures that he